You're listening to They Came From the North, your weekly, decidedly Canadian look at all of our favorite, and in some cases, most loathed filmmakers. Tonight we turn our vengeful north of the border eyes upon famed action director John McTiernan. I'm your host for the evening, the beast from the East Coast, John Mercer. With me as always are Prairie Thunder, Andrew Forbes.
I was hoping I could be the breast from the West.
Pierre Solange, Gabriel Girard.
Yippee-ki-yay, pauvre con.
And sweet and sour, Steve Power.
Fuck you.
Well, that was the best one, man.
Fuck you, I love you.
Yeah, sweet and sour, right? That one sentiment.
Yeah. You took what was a warm, loving gesture and destroyed it.
Up yours.
Quit.
Take it easy, Mr. Falcon.
Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon.
I'm going back to dental school. Before we get started, I'd like to just take a moment, if you're a first-time listener, just to go over our format for the evening. After we discuss a short bio about the director, we'll get into what we like to call our good, the bad, and the ugly. Good is pretty self-explanatory. It's what we feel is probably the director's most shitballs amazing, awesome work. The bad does not generally mean it's a terrible movie. The bad is a film that we feel is still good, but has a couple flaws that keep it from being the masterpiece we feel it could be. And the ugly, again, self-explanatory. This is where we get into just the utter shite.
Rage train!
That's when the rage train starts to roll. So with that, let's start. Like I said, tonight we're looking at John McTiernan. McTiernan was born in Albany, New York in 1951. He originally set out to become an actor, studying at the prestigious Juilliard School in New York City under producer-slash-actor-slash-Orson Welles collaborator John Houseman. He ended his education in the late 70s with a Master's of Fine Arts from the American Film Institute's Conservatory in Los Angeles, California, where he had studied under famed Czechoslovakian director Jan Kadar. He spent the decade following his graduation directing various short films and logging more than 200 television commercials before arriving onto the Hollywood radar in 1986 with the supernatural thriller Nomads, starring Pierce Brosnan, then best known as the star of TV's Remington Steele. While the film wasn't a commercial success, it oozed with style and earned McTiernan not only some attention at the Cannes Film Festival, but a rather large measure of film industry street cred. This recognition was parlayed into a gig as the director of the Arnold Schwarzenegger vehicle Predator, a smash hit that played a huge role in the rise of the Austrian Oak and made McTiernan a highly sought commodity for the post-Lethal Weapon action landscape. Questions of whether or not he could follow up on Predator's success would soon be answered with a rather enthusiastic, "Yes! Yes!" 1988's Die Hard silenced any voices of doubt of what McTiernan could do behind the camera. It became not only one of the biggest hits of the year, and effectively launched Bruce Willis's film career into the stratosphere, and pretty much raised the bar for the entire action genre, as filmmakers would try to copy the Die Hard on a blank formula for more than a decade following its release. However, despite Die Hard's critical and commercial triumph, John McTiernan would opt out of directing the sequel, instead choosing to helm the big-screen adaptation of Tom Clancy's monumental bestseller, The Hunt for Red October, featuring a Sean Connery in the midst of a career renaissance following an Academy Award in 87, a rising star in Alec Baldwin, and a cast rounded out with a bevy of skilled character actors. The movie conquered the box office in early spring of 1990, adding yet another $200 million feather in McTiernan's cap. He reteamed with Sean Connery in 1992 for Medicine Man, a romantic drama that felt worlds apart from the pulse-pounding action crowd-pleasers he'd built his career on. While it did make its budget back and is considered a solid effort, it wasn't the home run McTiernan had become known for, and these days is probably most fondly remembered for the Jerry Goldsmith score. In 1993, McTiernan suffered the first commercial flop of his career when Last Action Hero, a lavish send-up of the late 80s to early 90s summer blockbuster, hit the pavement with a sickening thud. Perhaps most mostly because it opened just 1 week after that summer's reigning heavyweight champ, Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park. Widely, and perhaps a little venomously panned by critics and received coldly at the box office, Last Action Hero has still become somewhat of a cult hit, and in recent years has received credit for some of its clever satire. Licking his wounds, McTiernan returned to the franchise that had made him, helming 1995's Die Hard with a Vengeance. Considered by most to be a grand return to form after the Last Action Hero debacle, the movie went on to be the highest-grossing film of the year, and has also developed a reputation as being one of the last true flag-bearers of that particular era of action films. With his good fortunes and box office clout restored, McTiernan signed off to write and direct the screen adaptation of Michael Crichton's Eaters of the Dead. Production began in 1997, but following poor test screenings, the relationship between McTiernan and Crichton soured, and the novelist seized control of the film. Its release date was pushed back more than a year, and because of reshoots and re-editing, the budget ballooned to $160 million. Released in late August of 1999 under the new title, The 13th Warrior, the movie did fail to remake its budget, suffering a net loss of nearly $100 million. That same year, mere weeks prior, in fact, McTiernan's remake of the 1968 Steve McQueen vehicle, The Thomas Crown Affair, starring a now famous for the role of James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, and Rene Russo, was met with much more open arms, making a very tidy $124 million on a budget of just under $50. Critics praised the romantic chemistry between the leads and noted that McTiernan's skillful eye with action sequences made the film's stunning robbery segments crackle. His stock once again on the rise, McTiernan moved forward with another remake, this time of the mid-70s cult hit Rollerball. Unlike Thomas Crown, Rollerball tanked hard in theaters in 2002, with critics damning it as an incoherent, mean-spirited mess. Moviegoers, of course, stayed away in droves. In 2003, McTiernan directed his final film to date before his legal troubles due to involvement in the wiretapping scandal surrounding private investigator Anthony Pelicano. That film, Basic, a Rashomon-esque murder mystery, failed to ignite viewer interest, and despite the presence of box office draws like John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, just narrowly missed recouping its $50 million price tag. What follows is a tangled web of bullshit that has kept McTiernan out of the director's chair for some time, and I'm sure the rest of the guys would agree with me that we'd prefer not to get into it. So rather, we'll do what we always do. Set out to celebrate, critique, and damn our own choices of Johnny Mac's good, bad, and ugly. So, fellas, can I get a yippee-ki-yay?
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker!
Mr. Falcon!
Who's up first?
I am.
That's Andrew?
Also, I want to ask, you know, what did you have to do to get Robert Osborne to write your intro?
I am Robert Osborne.
Ugh. Raising the bar? What an ass. All right, so I guess I'm starting with my good then.
Yes, you are.
All right, well, it's a somewhat qualified good, I have to say, because to be perfectly honest, my favorite movie, I think, of his is Die Hard, but I think there's, you know, it's a well-liked movie, but I really don't think there's enough love these days for The Hunt for Red October.
I love Hunt for Red October.
A lot of people do, but for some reason, it seems to sort of not get talked about as much as Die Hard, and I think they're almost on equal footing, although obviously Die Hard was a sort of formula maker, became a template for a whole new sort of series of movies. But Hunt for Red October, I think, it's sort of the rare smart thriller, certainly in the 90s, submarine flick. And surprisingly, given the amount of plot involved and, you know, soaring Russian military choirs and giant steel ships sort of slowly maneuvering in the depths, it feels like a really taut flick. Like it's, I would say it's easily the leanest of any of the Jack Ryan movies. Alec Baldwin playing Jack Ryan, I think, is far superior to, certainly superior to Affleck and superior to Harrison Ford as well. Harrison Ford sort of suffered in that he was in the huff and puff, give me back my family mode when he was doing his Jack Ryan's. And Alec Baldwin is just, you know, at his
absolute... Shit, fake, I'm just an analyst, Jack Ryan.
Oh, yeah, he's at his, you know, he's just old enough, I think, that he's, you know, he's got his craft really under control, but he's still got that youthful energy. He sells the fact that he's a smart guy, you know, given that he's at that stage in his life, but he's still just got that youthful charm. He just gives one little smile and basically just wins the audience over right away. And he's surprisingly good, you know, given how ridiculously handsome and charming he is, at sort of giving the impression of being totally out of his depth, just enough. So he walks a very fine line between being competent and being totally overwhelmed by the situation. I mean, the basic story is that Sean Connery, a Soviet sub-commander, is taking out the new technologically advanced Red October. Suddenly gets out of control. The Soviets don't know if he's planning to launch a strike or defect. The Americans don't know either. And Baldwin gets thrown right in the middle on a hunch that he is in fact trying to defect and turn over Soviet technology to the Americans. It's just an amazing movie. The score by Basil Poledouris is fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to mention that too.
It's, you know, probably some of the best sub effects you'll ever see. That iconic shot of the sub just launching itself out of the water, done, I believe, with a real submarine.
Yeah, it was.
And that's another thing going for it is, you know, they got a lot of military cooperation. So there's real American Air Force and Navy hardware on display. And it really feels like a very authentic story, despite the sort of fanciful super sub defection plot. Every time I go to it, I kind of think, oh, maybe have I seen this one too many times? Every single time, I'm totally hooked.
I also love the fact, I mean, it's obvious when the movie starts, you know, it's the Alec Baldwin and Sean Connery show, right? Mm-hmm. But they are surrounded with such just consummate acting muscle.
And Sam Neill's awesome.
Yeah.
Everyone else is an awesome man. Sam Neill, Scott Glenn, James Earl Jones. Daniel Davis.
Who died, I think, shortly after that. He was quite young.
He was also in Dune.
Richard Jordan as Jeffrey Pelt. Just great character actor who, unfortunately, died in 93 at only 56, but he plays what's his official role in the movie? I can't remember his official title, but he's very much a political animal who's sort of holding back the generals and giving Alec Baldwin a chance to test his theory out. And he's just hilarious.
He is.
I think he's the national security advisor.
Yeah.
I just love the fact, too, that he plainly spells out that his whole machination for even helping him is that on the chance that, like, he believes Ryan, and on the chance that Ryan is right, that is the ultimate feather in his cap. This guy's political career will be made.
Yeah.
And if Ryan is wrong, well, shit, he's expendable, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. He's just some analyst who...
And you're not getting any official support, mister, so...
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, great acting. I love the opening shot. And I was planning to get into this later when one of us, of course, will probably bring up 13th Warrior. I love the shot of the political officer on the Red October. He's speaking in Russian, the camera zooms in, and then it transitions to English.
Lips.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd want to talk about, like, economical filmmaking.
Yeah.
That's perfect. It tells you everything you need to know. It's just, all right, from now on, when they're talking Russian to each other, we're going to get that it's going to be English. You don't have to do any sort of complicated editorial backflips. And that's something John McTiernan's great at, is just economy. And I think, you know, as long as we're starting to talk about stylistic choices, he's made for this movie. He's known, I think, One of his biggest signatures is, you know, before J.J. Abrams became notorious for it, visible lens flares just everywhere. He loves to just blind the audience with huge floodlights, and it gives his movies a ton of atmosphere, a really sort of high-tech sheen, but he uses it really well. It's not gimmicky.
He uses it. I think what it is with the lens flares, and Abrams gets a lot of crap for it, and it's bullshit there too. It gives the movie an organic feel. It really makes it feel, you know, less staged,
less sterile.
You're watching.
I think the amazing thing though with McTiernan is, in addition to simply having it as a texture, he actually uses it when he's timing the rhythm of the action.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, lens flares come through. He's moving the camera, and the lens flare just blooms at exactly the right moment to give some kind of visual or dramatic effect. He's amazing at that.
In one notorious instance, I think it was with Die Hard, he even cues up a sound effect.
There was a musical cue.
Yeah.
He actually, I mean, I don't know how much that was McTiernan or
editing.
If it was, what's his face? Great composer. Name escapes me.
Kamen.
Yeah. But I'm sure he works closely with his composers as well, because you just get a sense with his movies that, the best one, that everything is just considered holistically.
I didn't have time to chime in, but that tactic of closing in on the guy who speaks Russian and then transitions into English, it's so good that Bryan Singer reused it for Valkyrie.
Yes, he did, yeah.
He does exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
I also really, really love Red October. There's just two things that kind of bug me about it. What kind of a name for a device is the caterpillar? I mean, it just
actually, you know what? I don't know if that's a language thing, but that to me sounds very much like the kind of thing that it would be called, as, you know, the kind of thing that it essentially crawls, you know, it's pulling with electromagnetism. We English speakers, we do stuff like that.
the other term they use in it is something magneto drive.
Yeah.
Or magneto hydraulic drive or something. It's
the thing about Red October and.
Wait, I had two things.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Back off, power.
The second thing is, Sam Neill is the only one who talks about is what he's going to do when he gets to the USA and talks about his dream. So, of course, he has to die, right?
Yeah.
He's also the only one who attempts a Russian accent.
He is.
Yeah, that is one of the things about the Red October crew is it's a mixture of various Eastern European assorted Euro trash types. I'm pretty sure there are a couple of Germans in there too. And then a Scotsman, and then an Australian who's doing a Russian accent. It is a bit of a mix, but somehow I don't find it as distracting, I think, as some people have.
No, not really. I mean, even I think Tim Curry tries for the accent too.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and it's really like Boris and Natasha kind of. Oh, I have a love-hate relationship with Tim Curry in that I love to hate him because I hate him.
The whole thing with me and Red October is what people kind of don't really realize or fail to remember, I guess, is a more accurate statement. It's based on a novel that was written in the early 1980s based on theoretical technology that may or may not have existed and was being kept uber secret, super hush-hush during the Cold War. So, you know, like, Clancy was really great at these techno-thrillers, but he had this air of authenticity about him because of his writing style and stuff, and when it was adapted, a lot of that translated. But people don't realize that just because it sounds authentic doesn't mean it isn't complete and utter total horseshit. You know, yeah. And there's a lot of horseshit in Red October, man.
Yeah.
It was solid gold techno babble.
You know?
I don't mind given that I'm essentially technically illiterate. So I'm fine with that.
Yeah. I was one of these military geeks. I mean, you know, in the 80s, I was reading G.I. Joe and Punisher comic books. I had read Red October. I'd read, you know, Stephen Kuntz's Flight of the Intruder. You know, like I was into all of this stuff. This stuff was what I was, you know, my elementary
school. I just watched Full Metal Panic. as far as I go.
This was the stuff I read in you know, elementary school and junior high, right? So it was...
I subscribed to Jane's.
Okay, first off...
It was the greatest magazine ever. Fuck you.
First off, Full Metal Panic is awesome. And secondly, to me, if you're going to damn the Caterpillar drive, you might as well damn the lightsaber.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It's technobabble, but it's solid.
It doesn't really hurt the movie, but... And my thing with it, like, the reason Hunt for Red October is not my good is it does feel kind of like a relic of that time. You know, like, you watch something like The Beast, which is, you know, we talked about a few weeks ago, and... It's a movie set in, you know, the Russian the Russian occupation of Afghanistan and stuff, but it doesn't feel like it's kind of stuck in the mentality of that era. Whereas you sit down and you watch The Hunt for Red October, it really feels jammed like crowbarred into that, you know, Cold War Red Scare.
But at the same time, you know, it opens. It's not saying, you know,
you got a Russian captain.
Could be any time. It opens. It says 1984.
Yeah.
And. Well, another thing I should mention, first of all, I have a soft spot for Cold War thrillers.
It warms
my heart.
I do enjoy a Cold War thriller. I really do, but Hunt for Red October kind of beats you over the head with it a little bit. It really does.
It still gives it more, like, I think, an authentic kind of feeling of, you know?
I kind
like
of agree.
Someone
it's
who
so
wasn't
much,
born
it's so much
into
of its time
that... Yeah, someone who wasn't born into... to that era, or, you know, didn't live through it, could get a feeling of what it was like while watching Unfortunate October.
I guess, but...
Okay, Steve, I'm going to say something, and it's probably going to make your head explode.
Okay.
For all of the ridiculousness in Hunt for Red October,
yep.
The vibe, it feels, because it's made at a time when, you know, Soviet-American or perhaps Russian-American relations are so much... part of the culture, it feels in many ways more authentic to me than a movie like Saving Private Ryan.
Fair enough.
You know,
I dig it. I can dig it.
The way the guys speak, it feels like they're aware that they're in a World War II movie.
but my problem with it is it's so caught up in that pastiche. And I mean, like, for me, I mean, I grew up in that era, so I had it in all my comic books. I had it in movies, I had it in novels, I had it on TV and like crappy counter-espionage shows, and it was just, you know, everything was the Reds, the Ruskies, and all of these Russian cats were all so horribly oppressed, and what is this McDonald's? I want Big Mac, you know?
Hey, American Joe, I wear Levi's jeans.
Yeah, you know, and it just, that just kind of grates on me.
I guess.
You know?
See, for me, you know, I was born in the early 80s. The Hunt for Red October was... I didn't get taken to the movies a lot as a kid. I'm not going to get all, you know, childhood trauma on you guys.
No.
But it was basically when I was around, you know, 8 or 9 years old that I really started becoming aware of movies. And The Hunt for Red October came out when I was 8. And it was a big movie that year. And something about it, it just, you know, it connects with me at that point where I was becoming more aware of the world. You know, I have vague memories of the wall coming down in Berlin. But it's just sort of that formative period.
I think that's the difference between us two is, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down and stuff, I was intimately aware of what was going on. I was following what was mm-hmm. going on. And maybe that's the difference, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's just an age thing.
Maybe it's probably just that you're really fucking old.
I'm not that old. Come on. I'm not Mitch Hedaway or Dan Mancini old.
Yeah.
Andy, yeah, that's true.
And, Andrew, you mentioned...
I turned 30 a couple weeks ago.
You mentioned it was reflective. A big movie that year. I think a lot of people have, especially like, you know, this isn't a movie that you've seen special edition DVDs of, or, right?
Yeah,
it's a whole... A lot of people forget how big Red October was. I mean,
it was huge.
And I think that's what I meant when I said, you know, it's not as talked about now.
Yeah.
This movie was huge.
Red October, the novel, is as ingrained in the 80s as something like Thriller. That was the book everyone was reading.
Yep.
Everybody, you know, you talk about Angels and Demons. In 1984, it was The Hunt for Red October. Or not Angels, sorry, The Da Vinci Code.
It was your creepy uncle's copy of Twilight.
And, you know, you're talking $200 million in 1990.
Yep.
Being made in theaters. Invented the idea that a movie did not have to open at Christmas time or summer to be huge. Red October created the early spring release.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I mean, yeah, Hunt for Red October and Terminator 2 are these movies that were just so present.
Yep.
In that, that couple-year period, it's just everybody was all about those.
And it's not to say that...
You know, you make fun of how cheesy Sean Connery is as an actor. At that point in his career, you know, he was a hot commodity.
And that's the thing. That's the thing right there. That's what made The Hunt for Red October $200 million. It starts with Sean. It ends in Connery. It was a Sean Connery vehicle. That movie was entirely a Sean Connery
and
vehicle.
And because you did use the unfortunate phrase, Sean Connery is a cheesy actor, he's brilliant in this.
He's
at that period in his career where he basically stopped coasting on the James Bond charm.
Yeah.
I don't really accuse him of doing that. I think he always had more than people maybe gave him credit for. But he's got a really great weariness.
Sean Connery
with that little
choices.
Touch of humor.
He made bad choices. He listened to the bad kids on the playground. That was Connery's problem.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, no. Like I've seen, you see movies where the man is absolutely brilliant.
The Untouchable.
I just really think that, I don't think Connery got super bad until late in his career. But I mean, after Bond, when you see stuff like Zardoz, it's just painful. Right. But I mean, like everyone forgets after, even before he won the Academy Award for The Untouchables. I mean, you had In the Name of the Rose. He was brilliant in that.
Excellent. Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah.
Hell.
You know, the man was at a point in his career where he was, you know, Steven Spielberg was saying Sean Connery he's an absolute treasure. Yes. And it's only now we're starting to realize that.
And I think he probably has Last Crusade in many ways to thank for Red October.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. I think it was the 1-2 punch of The Untouchables, then Last Crusade.
Mm-hmm. But Untouchables on its own, I don't think would have made it. I think that would have been sort of like, yeah, good job, Sean.
Yeah, he finally got his Oscar. Way to go. But then you had...
Good job, Sean. How do you explain The Presidio?
Yeah.
What was wrong with you?
I think too, the other side, the other thing about Red October, I mean, and this is not to diminish it. I still think Red October is an excellent flick, and I think it's the best of the Ryan movies by far.
To kick in the nuts for that new DVD or that new Blu-ray cover.
Yeah, no, this is the thing, and this is a kind of a curiosity I've been noticing actually, and the reason that The Hunt for Red October may not quite be quite so remembered nowadays, there seems to be a trend with late 80s and very very early 90s Paramount movies. They just kind of vanish. They just kind of slip under the radar. Stuff like The Untouchables, Hunt for Red October, even to an extent. What's that, Jeff?
The Presidio.
Well, but even to an extent, you know, Last Crusade. Like nowadays, people remember Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know.
Yeah.
But it just seems like late 80s Paramount. Pretty much everything they released kind of came, hit big, and then disappeared. I don't know if it's that they can't keep them relevant or they don't release them enough on, they don't revisit them enough on video.
Paramount certainly isn't being overly active in the home video front these days.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's a lot of it, you know? I think that's really, that has a lot.
And it's sick because, I mean, the guys do have, you know, quite a good library.
Yeah. But I do think that's why people don't really quite pick up, you know, Hunt for October is like, it's one of those things someone brings it up out of the blue and it's like, oh, I fucking love that movie, you know? But people just don't really, it's not something that pops up every day in conversation, you know?
Yeah.
Agreed. Or the other Jack Ryan movies either.
Yeah, yeah, true.
But, I think, you know, we're certainly at a time when we have a very different type of hero. If you're not able to do, you know, free running or mixed martial arts, you're not considered an action hero. It's like, if you're an action hero these days, you have to be punching people really, really fast.
You can't be an old fart from Scotland trying to do a Russian accent.
No. Hey.
Being dropped 50 feet out of a helicopter.
Yeah.
He's not Russian. He's Lithuanian by birth.
That's right. That's
so it
right.
makes sense that he has a different accent. That's what I keep telling people.
Actually, yes. And, you know, that totally makes sense for Sam Neill because he's the only person in the officers that's actually from Moscow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. John McTiernan, you cunning bastard.
Moving on to shake things up a bit, because I know what he's going to pick. Steve, what would you choose for the good?
I'm so torn on this one, man.
No, Steve. Be strong.
I'm so
be strong torn. And do it because this is going to be great conversation.
I am so fucking torn, man. I've got to go with the 13th Warrior.
Hooray.
I have Yay. To. I just that movie for me crackles with life from the moment it starts to the closing credits, man. It just to me is just such a it's
in the morning, the pus will run and you'll have a fever.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's the line I always remember from it.
No, but it's just it's something there's something about it. I love Antonio's performance in it. It's you know, up to that point, Antonio had a bit of a rep as a pretty boy. I mean, he'd done Desperado, but even then, I mean, all he had to do in Desperado was shoot people, you know. But he had a rep as a...
He did Assassins, and they went out of their way to show a shot of him pinning his hair into a ponytail.
Yes, exactly. You know, exactly. And, I mean, the less said about Assassins, the better. But, you know, it was him kind of showing that he had dramatic chops, and then you just had this collection of uber badasses. You know, you had Vladimir Kulich and... I think Andrew just got dropped. He'll come back, I'm sure. But no, it's man, I just there's so much in that movie. Like every minute of that movie, there's something that makes me want to just pump my fist, you know.
And I say this as somebody who was there opening night for 300, right? But we had something better than that 8 years prior.
Yeah, way better.
Yeah,
infinitely.
Way better. Yeah. It feels so so genuine, I think.
So textured.
Yeah.
Gabe, you should see, like, of course, you know, Steve and I hang out together. And when us and the crew get together drinking, and, you know, we've had a couple drinks into us, that's when the 13th Warrior quotes start happening.
It basically turns into the 13th Warrior. With Kev as our token Arab.
Yeah. And also, yeah, all the cast as well, and like they're very identifiable too, like all the characters,
even the ones who don't speak a whole lot.
Yeah,
it's just it's such a great movie. I you know from word go right to the end, I just it moves like stink. The costumes are mind blowing, just so amazing. You know, it's I love the movie so much.
And it's so I mean, it's so much more than just like the fighting, you know. There's character development, and it takes its time, you know, to get to the good stuff.
Peregrine the Joyous.
Hey, he's back.
Yeah.
Yeah, just
I'm
as just
lots
a quick
of irrelevant and redundant comments now.
Just as a quick recap for Andrew's benefit. 13th Warrior is better than 300.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a textured movie. Like the production design, the costumes, the character, it feels so lived in. It feels like such a real movie, you know?
And despite its reputation and all the post-production nightmares that went through it, honestly, guys, I've seen some movies that Michael Crichton has directed, and I've seen everything that John McTiernan has directed, and you're seeing 99% more McTiernan on screen.
There was a lot of talk, there was a lot of discussion about changing styles and stuff like this, but to be honest, you don't notice it. You really don't. No. I mean, if I sit there and I look for it, I can see it. I know...
Most of the changes were done in the editing room, actually.
Yeah. Well, no, there was 3 months or 4 months of reshoots, too, apparently.
Well, that's the time of the reshoots.
Yeah.
Who knows how much footage actually made it.
Yeah. But, I mean, you see the original trailer, the Eaters of the Dead trailer, and you can see that the DNA was definitely there. And I think, if anything, I think Crichton may have lightened it up a little bit. But overall...
Certainly all of the action is McTiernan.
Yeah, oh my God, yeah.
Yeah.
Big time.
I don't think Crichton would be capable of, you know, the shot when they're all walking forward and you have the shafts of light coming in through the trees.
Yeah.
Or the, you know, the firing the arrow out of the boat.
Amazing stuff. Just amazing.
That beautiful, beautiful shot of Antonio coming up out of the water, and you know it does the McTiernan whip camera, and he turns around, just sees all the Vendel go past him on horseback.
Yeah,
and they're
talking about the time when he comes out in the bikini with a conch shell.
I still can't believe that shot where the eater tears some guy's head off.
Yeah, there's no shortage of violence.
Derps the Viking. That was Derps, wasn't it? Because his head torn off.
I think so, yeah. Two of them.
Derpson, I believe.
A thing I really like is that you can feel them, you know, forcing to lifting their swords. It doesn't seem easy, you know?
Yeah, it's,
you can feel the force in the swinging. Yeah.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel like, I mean, yes, obviously the fight scenes were choreographed, but they were choreographed with an eye to realism, not to, like, looking fancy, you know? Mm-hmm. And
well, they were choreographed to the fact that these, you know, all of these guys are like 260-pound brutes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And, you know, when they swing a broadsword, it's going to hit with power.
And just the writing. I love the dialogue in the movie.
I mean, everything that comes out of Herger's mouth is just utter bliss.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic.
Andrew, I was saying earlier how every time me and the guys get together drinking, it turns into the 13th Warrior.
It does.
Because every time somebody refuses a drink, someone else clasps them on the shoulder and tells them that it's made of honey.
Yeah, it's made from honey.
And that shot near the end, I mean, when they all rise and say the low, I see my father.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Dude, that should be on a McTiernan sizzle reel.
Yeah, that is, to me, that is one of those.
You know what, speaking as a guy who, you know, Steve, I know you're a big fan of, you know, sort of rousing warrior speeches, I think.
I totally.
I actually have sort of a low tolerance for those.
Yep.
You know, Braveheart hit, and then it was just one after another, it seemed. And then with Lord of the Rings, it seemed even more.
Yeah, no, and they are hit.
But you know what? The way it's treated in this, I don't get any of the irritation I get with some others.
It's,
you know,
just,
It feels I guess emotionally honest, maybe, as opposed to sort of
forced.
All right, guys, this is the part in the movie where we're supposed to have the big speech about freedom and dying today.
What I love about it is mere minutes before that, you get the scene where I can't even remember his full name. Where Eben is, when Banderas is down, you know, praying for the first time in years.
Yeah,
and then you know when he goes and the guys start doing their Northman's prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of them at this point. You know, and it was never in the movie does it feel like he's got to earn his way into the, you know, they're pretty accepting of him as soon as he shows up, just, you know, for having the boss.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that I love so much about it. You don't have any of these growing pains. You don't have any of these, like, Stranger in a Strange Land moments and stuff. Right from the moment he's picked to go with them, they consider him one of them. Like, I mean, the first...
There's a bit of stuff, but, you know, I really love that scene when they give him a sword and he's just totally unable to use it. And then he goes to the grinder and he's just like, all right, grind this down. And everybody's looking at him like, what are you doing to that sword?
When you die, can I give that to my daughter?
What I love about it is as soon as he shows that it works, they're all like, okay.
The respect is there, you know? The mutual respect is there. It's just the culture clash, right?
Exactly. And
Right from the moment when he reveals that he's learned their language,
yeah,
you know, he's part of the group then. Right after that, you've got Bullwife comes up and asks him to show him that he can write.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as pure badassery goes, I have to mention that jump of Burvalve at the end where he sits down on the throne and
slams the sword.
I mean, I had shivers.
It was amazing. Amazing stuff.
That was a guy who it never feels forced in the movie, but the character is genetically engineered to be a badass. You know, he's going around the entire movie with his great big Irish wolfhound following him around everywhere. And the dog to him is nothing but a puppy, right?
Yeah.
But he is massive, and he carries himself with this type of Shakespearean just theatricality. He just – you can feel charisma just vibrating off this man.
He's a living Frazetta painting.
Yeah.
He hardly ever speaks, but, I mean, he just radiates power from the moment he's on camera.
Mm-hmm.
I just – you know, so many awesome moments in that movie, and Kulich is a big part of it too, you know, like the old
– If I ended up, you know, at the end of a dark alley and Vladimir Kulich – showed up in a remotely threatening manner, I would probably literally just stop living. Just be like, it'll be less painful this way. I'll just not be alive anymore.
And he used to play Canadian junior hockey.
Oh, really?
Yep. He, I believe it was with Quebec, somewhere in Quebec.
Hmm.
Which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I guess he's been... Yeah, his first credit is on Neon Rider. Yeah.
But he's... The guy is, like, in an intimidation powerhouse, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the
you
rest
want to talk
of...
talk about, like, the consummate Viking.
Yeah. And just everything about that movie is like that, though. Like, everything is just so perfectly realized.
Group, I love the entire group. I love, the, you know, yeah. the tracker. I thought you'd be in the tower. That is precisely why I am not.
Yeah, you know, it's just... Every piece of that movie seems to fit so well to me, despite all the trouble they had. And that was why I originally wanted to pick it for my bad, because of the whole reshoots, Michael Crichton, blah, 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 blah. But I think
for the fact that it overcame and is such an awesome movie despite everything.
Yeah, I just,
it deserves it.
Like, I mean, I said it when we did the Objection a while back, myself, Dave Johnson, and Dan Mancini. We did an Objection episode devoted entirely to the 13th Warrior. And I said it then, I'll say it again now. It's a top five movie for me, man. It's on my top five list. It's a movie that, even talking about it right now, I watched it last night. I want to go out, I want to start watching it again. I want to turn it on right now and start watching it.
Well, as long as you're wearing headphones.
I do. I am. Yes, I am.
Moving on. Gabe, what's your pick for the good?
Well, we've clearly kept the best for last, and that is Die Hard.
I'm just going to go out there and say it right now. Die Hard was also my pick for the good. So we're going to combine here a little bit for the sake of brevity.
Okay.
Is there really anything more that needs to be said about Die Hard? That's what I'm wondering.
I do a 3-hour podcast just on Die Hard.
I mean,
just on quotable lines from Die Hard.
I'm a podcaster. I've been doing it for 11 years.
That's problem. That's my problem of growing up and seeing dubbed for most of my life again. But even dubbed on TV and like missing a few minutes, it was still awesome.
I can't imagine Argyle in French.
You know what? I think he makes more sense in French.
I got everything in his mug. C, B, C, D, full bar, VHS.
That might be my favorite moment in it. It's like, we got VHS. Yeah.
I just...
What I really like about it, too, is like, Bruce Willis, he's badass, he cracks wise, but at the same time, you can feel like he's got like the tender center, too.
Mm-hmm. What I love about it, and I'm not going to say that Die Hard completely changed the game, because Lethal Weapon did come out the summer prior to that.
Yep.
I think they're very different flavors, though.
No, but all I'm saying is with Lethal Weapon, the seeds that were planted bloomed with Die Hard. Die Hard is... It represented the death of the Chuck Norris flavor of action movie.
Thank God.
Yeah, like, you've got... I mean, I still go back to some Norris cheese every now and again. You know, I own Code of Silence and Lone Wolf and Quaid on DVD.
I can't stand the man.
But
you're not the only one.
Yeah, you're not alone there. But, you know, John
sucking
McClane.
Sucking charisma vacuums.
John McClane, that's how I clock the length of darkness by how much of the shit he's got knocked out of himself as the movie goes on. And I love everything about it. You know, I love the Eurotrash villains. I love the whole setting, the whole, I mean, the building is absolutely massive, but it feels like, getting back to what we were talking about Red October, it just feels so claustrophobic.
But you know what? The great thing about the way McTiernan deals with it is, despite the fact he manages to make it feel tight and like you said, it's got that claustrophobic sense. But at the same time, he doesn't let it restrict him whenever it comes to energy and movement in the action scenes.
Yeah.
I love this. There's a whole bunch of little stuff in it. I love, the scene when McClane's in the familiar surround. He's after evading Carl and the guys up on the roof. As he runs past, he, kisses his hand and tags the big stand-up girl on the
Hello,
wall.
Hello, ladies.
The scene when the guys, when the terrorists arrive in the building, and you got they throw Gruber the ID card to lock the door, and he stops for a second, looks out in the parking lot, and then eyes his reflection in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in a lesser action movie, they just throw him the card, the thing slide down the door, you know, the big lock noise, and then move on, right?
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of these little little punctuations in Die Hard just make it feel
and,
so
and
perfect.
Since you brought this particular bit of film terminology up a couple of episodes ago, I have to say I love the way McTiernan uses Dutch angles in this movie. Like, especially during the confrontation between when Gruber is suddenly caught more or less red-handed, but is playing off as though he's one of the office workers who got separated.
Ew.
And Clint. You just sort of get this low look up at John McClane as he's sort of considering, you know, is this guy legit?
I love that the first thing you see there is the wiggling toes, the little details
through just subtleties and changing focus. It's such a deep, like it's so just meticulous.
Anyone who wants to make movies, Die Hard is something they should be studied, right?
Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. And not just action movies.
No. I mean there's a great use of the whole widescreen frame, and the way he does a lot of continuous shots too. And I love, like, on the, I think it's the special edition DVD, there was like the special feature about how full frame is shit and widescreen's better.
I was gonna ask if you'd seen that.
Yeah. And I think it's the shot of like when you first see the vault.
It is, yeah.
That they're using as a demo, and that's a great shot.
Mm-hmm.
My when we were doing the just getting ready to record earlier, Gabe was mentioning the his sideways camera panning.
Yeah,
there's a horizontal, whatever you want to call it. I'm not a film student.
Horizontal tracking.
Yes, tracking shots. The shot of McClane when he's under the table, and I think it's Marco is the.
Yeah.
He's standing on top of the table, just stalking him with the.
No more table.
Where are you going to go now, pal?
And also, what's amazing about it is how well the humor, you know, fits with the action and doesn't feel detrimentary, you know?
It doesn't.
It doesn't detract from the drama. It feels like natural humor that's coming out of a really tense situation.
Yeah.
Now, I have a gun. Ho, ho, ho.
Now, I have a machine gun. Ho, ho,
ho.
I just,
as opposed to, you know, when people started ripping it off and, you know, you have, like, sudden death with Van Damme. And, you know, they try to throw, you know, action movies, they try to throw wisecracks in there. And, you know, there's a difference between Die Hard and those movies. You know, those movies that felt like, all right, you know, we're supposed to have some kind of witty comment when we kill a bad guy or whatever. In Die Hard, it really does feel like it's coming out of the characters as opposed to coming out of an overly aware writer.
Yeah.
Dare I mention Last Boy Scout here?
Hey! Last Boy Scout's amazing.
I just love, you know, I was talking earlier how you can clock the time in the movie by how badly he's beat up in it.
By how many of his own fluids are seeping all over him.
I mean, the wisecracking, it doesn't really slack off so much, but towards the end of the movie, you can really feel McClane's desperation in that kicking in. You know, case in point, when he's on the stairs pounding the ever-living shit out of Carl, the 8-foot-tall Ubermensch. You know, he's basically sitting on top of the God of Thunder beating his face in and, you know, just screaming at him. You should have heard your brother scream when I broke his fucking neck.
I'm going to kill you. I'm going to cook you. And I'm going to fucking eat you.
We have to mention, of course, Alan Rickman as Hans Gruber, one of the best villains of all time.
Yeah.
So intelligent, and
I believe this was his film debut, was it not?
It was.
Yeah. It was in his late 40s, I might add.
And cutting quite a dashing figure. I have more than a slight man crush on Hans Gruber. When he's walking in, you know, when they're all arriving and he's walking in, there's that one, you know, long lens shot of all the thieves walking towards camera and his coat's just sort of flapping out in the wind. Man. I would kiss that.
You wanted to buy a plane ticket and hop over to John Phillips of London.
I've got your detonators right here, Hans.
At least you don't have a man crush on Reginald Val Johnson.
Be my uncle.
I think it's, you know, it is one of the, you know, seminal great action masterpieces. One of the seminal action masterpieces. You know, it is, you know, and
it's deserving of every bit of acclaim it
gets. I don't even think, you know, I mean, like, I love the movie. I totally love it. I don't love it quite as much as The 13th Warrior, but, you know, be that as it may, I'm crazy sometimes. But
Steve, Booby, we haven't talked about the real star of this movie yet.
But no, the thing with Die Hard is not just when you look at, you know, movies of the 80s, the action boom of the 80s, but I'm talking action movies, period, full stop, from the dawn of modern cinema. Die Hard.
Right from Stagecoach.
Honestly, you know, for all of the increased, I guess, capacity for impressive stunt work and hiding, you know, the camera tricks that have come out in the last few years, I don't think there has ever been a better action movie made.
Yeah, it's
and I don't
just
mean that just in the sense that I love Die Hard because it's from a certain time in my life. Technically, you know, in terms of filmmaking, I don't think it's ever been equal.
It's a damn brilliant movie. It is a damn brilliant movie. But my thing with it is I almost prefer it when it goes a little bit more subservient. I almost prefer it when it kind of subdues itself a little bit. Like the scene, like you mentioned, with Bill Clay. You know, where you have any experience with this, Bill?
Clay.
You know,
Bill.
Yeah.
Clay.
Oh, I went to one of those.
That wasn't even in the script for the movie. They realized Rickman could do a serviceable American accent.
Keyword serviceable.
Me off or what?
We also have to remember that Terry Gilliam on 12 Monkeys commentary mentions the scene where Bruce Willis is picking glass out of his feet and talking to his wife, and he's like, that's the moment I knew this guy had some depth.
Mm-hmm. Just one second, guys. Sorry about that, Beth wanted some with Jacob.
Mm. Understand. No,
everything's fine. I love a little bit of Dirt. You know, there's so much of it. You know, I love the scene when McLean and Gruber are talking to each other in walkie-talkies, the whole
don't work for Nakatomi. Sorry.
Give me my detonators or shall I shoot another one? Sooner or later, I'll get to somebody you do care about. they keep switching sides, so they're almost it's like they're facing each other.
Because of Nakatomi's legacy of greed, they are about to be taught a lesson in the real use of power. You will be witnesses.
It's just, it's one of those movies to me, I get the same feeling watching this as I do watching Raiders of the Lost Ark. I can remember, not just remember the first time I saw it, I can remember each and every feeling I experienced watching that movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can still remember the whole preteen giggle the first time I heard, take this under advisement, jerkweed.
I was 10 years old when I saw Die Hard. I can't recall if I saw Die Hard first or The Terminator first, but I saw them at the same friend's house, either on the same day or within a couple of weeks of each other. And, you know, it was my first exposure to realistic movie violence. And, you know, I remember how I reacted to it. You know, I was kind of horrified. But at the same time, I think I appreciated, it was the first time I actually appreciated that, you know, actual danger and darkness in movies can be a good thing. Because up to that point, I'd been watching like Little Mermaid and shit. So, I mean, it had a profound effect on me.
Yeah. I can't remember. I think I actually saw the second Die Hard before I saw the original.
That's unfortunate.
And I love Die Hard, too, for different reasons, but I still love Die Hard, too. But,
hey, Carmine, what sets off the metal detectors first? The shit in your brains or the lead in your ass? That doesn't make sense.
But it makes awesome. Sense when it comes from the mouth of John McLean. But, no, I don't know. It just it changed the way I look at movies, and I got to agree with you, Andrew. Since I saw it, I've never seen another action movie that's even seen. Like, I've seen plenty of stuff that I'm like, oh, man, that's awesome. But just nothing on a technical level, and just you know, I've even seen movies where the scale of Die Hard has been matched easily. It's just nothing meshes as perfectly.
And it's one of those movies that seems to get even better each time you watch it, even as time goes on.
It's a regular. Before I moved out, you know, when I was a teenager, this was something that nobody seemed to understand. But my sister and I used to sit down on Christmas Eve and watch Die Hard.
Because it's a great Christmas movie.
Yeah, my wife certainly doesn't understand. She's like, "Do you want to watch Christmas with the Cranks? Die Hard, Christmas movie."
Christmas with the Cranks.
Christmas movies have Christmas trees, John. Die Hard's got a big Christmas tree. It fucking explodes.
Die Hard has more red than any other Christmas movie.
My wife's horrible taste in movies, notwithstanding. And with that, I think that's a perfect segue to our choices for the bad. I'm going to – who did I start with last time?
Andrew?
Yeah.
You know what? Gabe, we're going to start with you today.
I'm going with Medicine Man. It's a movie about this scientist played by Sean Connery who's somewhat lost in the jungle. And this young assistant played by Lauren Bracco comes in to find him and find out what's going on, and he has the cure for cancer, of course. It's a movie that seems to get worse as it goes along. I mean, the beginning is kind of interesting, and I mean, the scenery, of course, is amazing. But, I mean, the female character, she's just so grating and just badly written. I mean, this is supposed to be a serious scientist doing some works, but she just keeps on complaining and calling for help. And, you're supposed to buy that they end up together at the end, and that doesn't make any sense. But
you know, it may be actually one of the rare cases where the age mismatch works in Sean Connery's favor here, because he's dealing with an extremely grating woman and he's way too old for her, so you know, they're both flawed.
But at least Sean Connery's good in it.
Cure for fucking cancer and I lost it.
Spoiler alert, it was ants.
There's some good scenery and some good action shots, but in the end, it's not really memorable or that entertaining either. It's just like there.
And it kind of felt like the adult's version of Fern Gully. It was like rainforest good.
You just stole my bit.
It was Medicine Man was actually entirely written as a Sean Connery vehicle. And McTiernan was brought in late, from what I remember hearing. It was something that Connery wanted him after Hunt for Red October and got him, kind of thing.
Well, he and Connery got along fantastically, actually.
Yeah, I think it was just kind of one of those hired gun situations for McTiernan.
I think Connery's like executive producer on that flick or something.
Pretty much everything Connery did after Red October, he was a producer on.
Oh, okay. But yeah, I mean, there's not that much to say about it because it's not really an interesting movie in any way.
I think John Campbell McTiernan. That's a good Scottish sounding name. And my favorite director.
I think it is worth mentioning that I believe it was around the time of Medicine Man that Connery won Time Magazine's Most Sexiest Man.
Red October is when he won it, actually.
Red October?
Red October.
I thought it was
a sexy hairpiece.
But I don't know. Medicine Man never really did it. There's some like stunning jungle shots earlier, and it's like some really complex. You imagine like the rigs they had to use for moving around, moving the camera on the trees and that. But it yeah, like, talking about a movie about a man who found the cure for fucking cancer and then lost it. And it just, I don't know, it just doesn't feel like there's anything really at stake in the movie. I think it concentrates a little too much on the romantic angle.
It's the kind of movie that it is, though.
I think it's a culture shock. You know, after the trilogy of awesome that was Predator, to Die Hard, to Hunt for Red October.
Yeah.
You know, Vic Tiernan was spreading his wings a little bit, but it just, it didn't feel genuine. It really did feel like a hired gun piece.
It's a guilty pleasure for me.
I don't know. Just looking at it from a sheer plausibility standpoint, the idea that, you know, cures for cancer are sort of like mixed up, like you're making cookies in the jungle, as opposed to very meticulously distilled in labs and...
wouldn't that be nice?
I can't remember if it was one tablespoon of butter or two.
One shot that really made me... That really made me go ooh was like they're mixing the like breaking up the flowers and stuff and mixing it with all the village people, and there's this shot that's basically at breast level, and you see like when like jungle woman breast, and like Lauren Bracco like wearing her shirt. I was like, what the fuck? What is this?
Cut to a shirtless Sean Connery, so you had saggy old man breast. Just to like mess with all the 13-year-olds who are like, boobs. Oh no, boobs.
She like these titties.
Japanese chests are bare. Not mine.
What about you, Steve? What's your pick for the bad?
For bad? Yeah. I'm going to go with probably next to The 13th Warrior, my most loved John McTiernan film. Yes, more than the original. I have to go with Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Ooh. Magnificent action movie.
And this is my problem with Die Hard with a Vengeance. I think on its own, it is an absolutely phenomenal piece of action filmmaking. I think it's a more suspenseful, more driven, faster paced, better acted, better executed action movie. It's just, it is, technically speaking, an awesome, awesome, amazing movie. But it doesn't have that certain je ne sais quoi that Die Hard has. You know, it's not as good a film in, like, all-encompassing as the original Die Hard.
All right, I just regained consciousness.
But it's one of those things where I have so much more fun with it than I do with the original Die Hard. The original Die Hard for me now, I don't know if it's just I'm burnt out on it or what, but I find there are certain elements. Like I said earlier, I like the original Die Hard when it's subversive. I like it when it doesn't go so crazy, when he's not tying a fire hose around himself and jumping off a building, which I think is just fucking stupid. But, you know, like...
Well, what would you do in a situation where a helicopter's
crashing on the roof and standing on an explosion? Don't defend it. It doesn't need to be done. The movie has more than enough defenders. Let it go. Just let it go.
I'm just thinking about plausibility... You know, that versus some of the things in...
Outrunning
the water in the tunnel and then getting thrown up like Wile E. Coyote out of the manhole, or driving a car through a 2-foot concrete slab to jump onto the lower road, or escaping a giant fireball, or falling from an enormous height onto a cargo container... And not being completely broken.
It's no better. It's no better, but
It's another moment of if you're going to do that, you might as well make fun of the lightsaber.
Yeah.
And Sam Jackson not getting killed wearing that sign in Harlem.
No, but it's just, to me, I enjoy it more as a film, but the problem where I come with it as a bad is it does not feel like a Die Hard sequel. Bruce Willis is not John McClane in this movie. He's Joe Hollenbeck. It is.
Except I even, you know, but it doesn't have that Shane Black magic that Joe Hollenbeck had in Last Boy Scout.
I think it does. I still think it does.
No. I feel the dialogue in Die Hard with a Vengeance, it just grates on me. It feels, it's a movie as a whole, you know, McTiernan does a great job with the action sequences. I don't know if we mentioned it before we started recording or not, but that opening scene of the explosion in the storefront.
Oh, it's amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But to me,
Courage just flipped over.
Die Hard with a Vengeance just keeps lumbering to more and more implausible heights. And eventually it's just, you end up with this sort of like mini atomic explosion in the Hudson River or wherever they are. And it just feels like, I'm amazed that you say it feels faster paced than Die Hard.
I find it is. Honestly. I do. I find it moves from point to point really quickly. I find Die Hard meanders a bit in the middle act. I love Die Hard. I do. I love Die Hard. I'm not dissing Die Hard. I'm just saying I prefer With a Vengeance.
I'm going to say, you know, I respect the fact that you prefer this, but...
But you're wrong.
I just have to say, to some degree, I'm flabbergasted.
I'm not saying it's a better film. I'm just saying I prefer it. This is what I'm saying. But...
That's because you're crazy, Steve.
Well, you know, whatever.
But yeah, two things that bother me. That's my new gimmick. there's that the water puzzle at the beginning. Whatever, like they have to transfer the water, like from. I mean, are we in elementary school again?
But that kind of fits the whole Simon Says aspect of it, right?
Kind of.
I think there were three action movies that year that tried to throw in the whole riddle gimmick in there. You had Die Hard with Vengeance, Batman Forever, and GoldenEye, and it didn't work in any of them.
You said Batman Forever, I'm in shock.
You know, Die Hard with a Vengeance,
that sort of riddle aspect, it feels the same as that, you know, the hoary old serial killer cliche of the serial killer who leaves clues at all of his murders and is really tracking the detective who's on the case. To me, like, it feels so contrived. And I just can't connect with it as well. I mean, there's a lot that I like in it, but at the same time, I also feel like it spreads its attention across way too many characters. We don't need Graham Greene in there. We don't need the police captain in there. We don't need especially the other cop lady who seems to be there just to take calls. She can get out of there. It just feels like it's just loaded down with all it. And I think that probably comes from it being that merger of two movies that originally being developed as something totally different. And
no, I think, honestly, I think the whole ancillary cast is kind of what makes it a Die Hard movie.
I love that about it. I love the cast.
You know, the first one had Reginald Bell Johnson, Sergeant Al Powell, Deputy Chief Dwayne T. Robinson.
These were all people who were converging on one point, and it was a clash of personalities. And in Die Hard with a Vengeance, I feel it's just people who are there, and
doing a job. They're all cops. They're all involved in the situation. It's
Graham
not
Greene,
just John McClane anymore.
I will never buy Graham Greene as a New York police detective.
But this is the problem. What you're doing again? You're comparing it to the first one. And
no, I'm just as a movie, I feel like it feels so much more artificial to me. I agree. There are certain aspects here that I'm talking about in relation to Die Hard, but also, I just feel like it's not focused as an action film. It's trying to be grand and have this citywide emergency going on, and I get taken away from the characters, and I just feel like it kind of lumbers around. But that's my problem.
I also have to mention that the last action sequence with the helicopter just feels very blah to me.
Oh, I thought you'd love that. They're in Quebec.
Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like it goes off like a chump, basically. Irons. It just crashes into a pole or something.
Actually, I think that's some of the best editing in the film, though.
I like that sequence.
Where
I
it's
do.
Cutting back.
It's way better than the original.
Using lights. In, you know, extremely well choreographed, well timed sequences, there's somehow the helicopter turns and there's this giant lens flare, and then it just disappears behind Jeremy Irons, and you see him there with this great big grin, like he's just going to kill Don McLean.
And an M60.
And yeah, it's. I don't know. Here's a little bit I have to throw in about being, you know, seeing this movie. I saw this in the theater in Fiji when I lived there when I was 12 years old. I was a Canadian kid across, you know, on the other side of the planet. And there's this thing about, I don't know if it's universal for Canadians, but I kind of think it is. There's this sort of thing where, you know, if in an American movie somebody mentions Canada, we're all like, yeah, they mentioned us. And I was there homesick, and just the fact that it's pretty pathetic. Just the fact that Jeremy Irons says, you know, the helicopter's ready to take off for Nova Scotia. I was like, fuck yes. They said Nova Scotia. We're like a real place now.
I will say that Jeremy Irons is my favorite villain of the series, and I don't care what anybody says. I really don't. You can defend.
Holy Toledo!
I think he's I think he's fantastic, and I think he chews scenery like nobody's business. And I really think that, like,
I'll agree with that.
I love his performance in it.
Do I get to shout any of my lines? Delicious.
Again, I don't think it fits well with Die Hard and Die Hard 2, which I thought, like, I mean, I think Die Hard's, again, one of the classic action movies, and I actually think Die Hard 2 is a great sequel to it, but With a Vengeance does not fit at all.
Oh, sorry I beat up on your choice, Steve.
That's okay.
I love you.
Well, it's pretty good because he's going to get a chance to return the favor. Andrew, what's your choice for bad?
Yeah, are you ever? Because my choice for bad, and again, it's one of those qualified bads where actually I kind of love it, is Last Action Hero. Which was
See, you took the chicken shit way out.
What? No way.
That's a horrible movie anyway.
No, I like this movie. Yeah, Last Action Hero is like Who Framed Roger Rabbit mixed with True Lies. Which sounds as wonderful and terrible as it is.
Is the word I would use. Terrible. There are about 10 minutes of good screen time in that movie. And
all of which feature Charles Dance.
Yeah, the rest of it is just so bad.
I love this movie. It's the most absurd concept ever, that there's a magic ticket that takes this kid, especially, you know, a magic ticket from Harry Houdini, because escape artists can pass between dimensions, apparently.
Yes, that's how he got out of the tank. Whenever I watch Last Action Hero, you gotta wonder, how many people worked on that script?
It is such a just like massive lumbering beast of, you know, so many cooks in the kitchen.
There's an amazing article out there, actually, amazing newspaper article or magazine article.
How they built the bomb.
It's Shane Black talking all about his experience with Last Action Hero, and it was absolutely fantastic.
You know,
Shane Black is awesome.
Shane Black is awesome, and I don't know. I didn't read this article. I don't know what his experience was like.
Oh, horrible! His fingerprints are terrible.
But despite that, his fingerprints are still all over it.
And like it's a testament to how ridiculously out of control Arnold Schwarzenegger was in the early 90s, man. Like,
yeah,
just how excessive the man was.
It's kind of amazing that True Lies, you know, if he didn't team back up with Cameron, I don't think his career would have really continued because he needed True Lies after that. But, you know, it is insane. I can't deny that when I watch it, I just get, like, giddy.
Yeah.
I love it. And it probably, you know, it's probably helped by the fact that I'm younger than you. And so I was looking at it probably less as, what a fucking annoying kid. Which I'm sure was a big part of your reaction.
He's actually probably the best part of the movie.
He's actually, as kid actors go,
he's not too bad.
You know, he's actually a great kid actor and a terrible haircut.
Apparently John McTiernan almost killed him twice making the movie. But they were friends afterwards.
Out of rage or?
No, just like really, really horrible management of stunts.
Yeah.
John Landis.
Oh, God.
Did I just say that?
Yeah. I can't defend it. I love it. It's.
I'll only say one thing. To be or not to be. Not to be.
I think the key word we had to use with Last Action Hero, and Andrew, you hit the nail on the head. Or no, Steve said it, actually. Excessive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that the idea behind the movie, and I mean, I think it's awesome. You know, I love the whole Roger Rabbit meets late 80s action movies. That's great. And you know, in the with less cooks in the kitchen, it could have been awesome, but it's just, you know, the budget just ballooned out of control.
It was by very definition.
To be fair, you see every single penny on this screen.
But it was by very definition, it was a runaway production, you know?
Mm-hmm. I read the interview with Mick. Gabe, go on.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I still can't believe that some people don't see that it's actually a parody of how excessive action movies were at that time, at the same time. I mean, the action stuff, like, in the movie, it's so excessive. It's like Andrew said, it's like True Lies. It's so over the top that you can't help but laugh at it.
Mm-hmm.
Or with it, rather.
That's right. Laugh with it, because it's great.
I read a great interview with McTiernan, and he said
the magic quote about Last Action Hero from McTiernan?
I don't know. He said the two things he learned about while filming or from the what happened with Last Action Hero is, number one, don't ever open a movie a week after Jurassic Park. And he said that it was, to him, you know, the studio would do anything to rush it into theater. He wasn't done editing the movie. He said there's stuff you see on camera that is just, it is literally right after he hit stop, right after he called cut. He didn't get a chance to edit the scenes. And we were talking earlier about, you know, this is a guy who does know the editing job. He said filming Red October, he had to fire a Academy Award winning editor from that movie because I just would not. McTiernan's always been a big fan of cutting, you know, from moving shot to moving shot. Now, he's not as out of control with his most action directors nowadays. But, I mean, like, the whole MTV style of shooting an action movie kind of, it's got McTiernan's DNA. And he said, you know, Last Action Hero to him feels like a supermodel that's got 20 pounds of extra weight on her. To him, there's still some beauty to be seen there, but it's just, there's way too much fat he did not get a chance to trim off.
Well, whereas my reaction is, hey, that's a whole lot of woman.
whole lot of Rosie. His quote, actually, McTiernan's big money quote about Last Action Hero was, Last Action Hero was the worst time I've ever had in this business. So he's not a fan.
Wow, was that quote before or after 13?
Ice that guy, to cone a phrase.
Oh, and I could not think of a better segue to go to my bed. And it's going to shock a lot of people because it's a movie that I fucking love and have watched endlessly. But I can't think of a better bed than Predator.
John, you my dog.
Predator is a movie that I first saw on ASN as a little boy. My first experience with Predator was with the Turner Broadcasting edits.
Oh.
You know, you ducking egg roll and Yippee-ki-yay, Mr. Falcon.
All the gore trimmed out.
Yeah. So, you know, your Predator on television was 45 minutes long.
The only part of Predator, and actually the first bit of Predator I ever saw, was the one point in the movie where the Predator's cleaning the skulls and ripping the spinal column out. And I was like, oh, my God, I was like 5 years old.
I saw it on ASN, and, you know, it was at that age, I'd say I was probably about 7. So my cousin sitting out on Friday night, just turn on ASN because they used to have badass action movies on. And back in those days, we didn't know anything about that things were edited for content. And here we're seeing, you know, oh, awesome, it's an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. You know, the first thing we see is the whole stick around. This badass attack on the cannon. We had no idea like an alien was going to come in. It really seemed like the coolest movie ever. And I've been going years and years and years, you know, oh, Predator's so awesome. Predator's so awesome. And I look back and I watch it. That is a horribly acted movie.
It's a pretty hokey flick, man.
Yeah.
It's a pretty hokey movie. But goddamn, that action is amazing.
Yeah, you've got basically a walking collective of beef jerky.
Yeah.
You know, the characters are larger than life, but it's just you hear them all mangling their lines. Andrew, you did one earlier. It was absolutely hilarious. The Anna's line about the demon that makes trophies of men.
The demon that makes trophies of men.
Everybody in it stumbles over the
rose very hot.
I have a friend. I'm not going to name him. But until about last year, he didn't actually know what that line was. And he honestly thought that she was saying something about this demon is making strophis of men. He was like, I don't know what strophis is. Is it some kind of food?
I thought you were going to say something then I'd have to speak a truth about myself. I have this friend who thinks that Predator 2 is a better movie.
He's right. Cool. He's right.
Babylon.
Maybe that's...
No, Jerry!
Maybe that's one point where I benefited of watching it dubbed in French.
I give Predator a few points, though. I think that alien design was absolutely freaking amazing. Mm-hmm. I think
Stan Winston was the best in the business.
Winston Cameron just had just as much to do with it as Winston. The two of them were on a plane.
Well, apparently Cameron was like, I always wanted to see mandibles on something. So he was like, so he sketched in these little mandibles on the mouth, and so that's where those came from.
Yeah, apparently they were both passing the notepad back and forth, and like Cameron came up with the mask, and Winston came up with the face, and like just the tech and everything came from Cameron, but the organic look came from Winston, apparently.
Hmm.
But
the Predator is such a badass looking monster.
It is, it is, and the action in that movie, man, that attack on the Colombian camp, that is one awesome 25-minute chunk of action, man.
You know, despite the whole, I ain't got time to bleed.
You know, in spite of all, you know, the 80s machismo.
You know, I find when I go back to watch Predator, I find it a bit of a chore. I'm, you know, honestly, I don't think that much of it is very good. But definitely it's the last...
Better than Commando?
Way better than Commando. Come on now.
You know what? I think Predator and Commando are kind of on the same level, except that Commando knew it was ridiculous.
I always say that Predator, made a comment earlier in the bio, Predator is really, you know, Schwarzenegger had a couple movies before that, you know, Conan, he was in Conan the Barbarian, the guy was just, he was a freak of nature on camera, right? They just grabbed the biggest, buffest guy they could find and put a sword in his hand. You know, everyone remembers the Terminator really fondly. Nobody seems to remember that we all saw the Terminator on home video. That's not a wide release movie. Right? Mm-hmm. The only people who saw that in theaters lived in New York and Los Angeles. And you had stuff like Commando and everything. Predator was really what cemented Arnie as one of the kings of 80s action.
Predator was his big budget breakthrough. Predator was Arnie's Hollywood movie. Yeah, and the other thing I'll give Predator, and I'll give Arnie in Predator, it's one of maybe three movies in that guy's career that he actually tried to play a different persona. He wasn't playing Arnold Schwarzenegger in that movie. He was dead serious in that movie. And it showed. You know, Dutch Schaefer was a serious badass.
Yeah, you know, you make fun of some of the lines he had and everything. But I mean, I love the stuff like Wheel of
Assassins. What's the matter, pushing too many pencils?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't do this kind of work.
Yeah,
we're a rescue team, not assassins. You know.
Okay, I have to bring out. I have to tell you guys what's your one ugly motherfucker dubbed in French. T'as pas une face de porte-bonheur.
And yeah, that's like another part. I look right after the horrible jumping on the waterfall shot.
You know, was the deal? Did they just like suddenly decide, hey, let's do this in 8mm?
I believe the whole deal with that shot was that it was a really long zoom.
And so they couldn't light it, and so they had to have...
Yeah, it was zoom, like they were using, you know, 150 or 175mm lens, and they were zoomed from like across the canyon.
Everything after that, from the moment Schwarzenegger covers himself in mud, and you can see how ridiculously huge his eyeballs are. And all, you know, his final fight with the Predator, it's pure awesome.
And
that moment.
Yeah. It's a pretty intense movie at times.
Actually, yeah. I think it may have something to do with the fact that they get rid of all the annoying team members. But
in really awesome fashion, too.
Yeah, but just in terms of, like, you know, McTiernan's action direction, it is that last sort of 20 minutes that I think is the best part of the movie. And especially, you know, it finally gets dark and, you know, you start getting that, you know, he's covered in the gray mud, and it's a different kind of dark from, you know, Night in the Jungle. It's this muddy, just dirty, murky, you know, crawling through water, and something about that, I think I just like it a lot more. And the fact that it's suddenly so focused on just the two of them.
And man, I love the whole, I love the desperation in Schwarzenegger. You know, this is the first time he's seemed vulnerable in a movie. And it's, I mean, I think Dave Johnson, you saw us make the comment that in Commando.
Hang on. That's not quite true. I have to say, because there is, you killed my mother, you killed my father, you killed my people! Conan.
Oh, yeah, like, okay, first time in a non-sword and sorcery vein.
First time he has to just beat out of him by one other guy.
I think Dave Johnson made the comment in Commando, you know, the guy jumps off an airplane landing gear and survives a fall that would kill a Stegosaurus.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know, it's one of the only times in an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie you're sitting out watching saying, God damn, that thing's going to kill Arnold.
And, you know, Arnold, in a movie full of huge guys, is the hugest of them. You know, I don't know if actually so or if just in the way it was filmed.
I think it kind of went back and forth between him and Ventura, actually. I think Ventura was pretty damn big in that movie, too.
Ventura was, but when
Ventura's talking, the behind-the-scenes stuff is hilarious.
As opposed to, you know, Arnold had that, he was enormous, but at the same time, you got the sense that he could move fast. I didn't get that from Ventura.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah.
Suddenly Arnold is, you know, facing this thing that's, you know, a good 2 feet taller than him. And it just seems... It makes an impression, you know, when the whole movie he was this giant and suddenly he's just dwarfed. He almost feels like Bruce Lee facing up to
that's a testament to just how awesome a monster design the Predator is.
Yeah. Hmm.
And, of course, it will always be the movie that gave us Get to the Chopper!
Interesting bit of trivia. Originally, I don't know if originally, but at a certain point in the production, Jean-Claude Van Damme was actually going to be in the suit.
Originally,
yeah,
he was in the suit for the first 2 weeks of shooting, and he
was like, it's too hot.
He hated it. He's in one scene in the movie as well. He's in the attack on the rebel camp. He's actually one of the captured pilots.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I think I saw Sven in there, too.
Yeah, Sven's in there, too.
Sven's always in there.
Yeah.
Russian bastard.
One of the things about... I have to say, you know, contrasting this and Die Hard, Die Hard has a big score, but it's big in a way that really feels like it's propelling the action. And Predator... The score, I find, overwhelms it. It's just kind of like this big, goopy swath over the whole thing.
I actually really love Predator's score.
You know, I like the score in terms of, just like, musically, I like it. But I kind of feel that it slows the movie down almost. It's kind of like...
It overscores instead of underscores.
Yeah. And, I don't know. Whereas Kamen's score for Die Hard is one of the greatest action scores ever.
Yeah.
I think. Mm-hmm. Beethoven helps, but it is mostly Kamen. To be fair, the way he adapts Beethoven is brilliant.
Same way he handled, what was the, Die Hard with a Vengeance. Johnny Came Marching Home.
Yeah. I love that. I love
That's
it.
That's right.
It worked out, and the score was awesome.
Yeah.
The scene when Jeremy Irons takes over the bank.
Yeah.
Right, and you start getting the bleed into the,
and it goes on forever. It's in the movie for like 10 minutes. Who's next?
We're all.
I was the last one. Now we're moving on to some truly reprehensible shit. And I'm just gonna go out and say it right now because I know at least three of us picked it. It should have been all four of us unanimously, but myself, Steve, and Gabriel are all in agreement. So I'm going to let you guys say it. What's our choice for ugly?
Rollerball.
And so that, you know, because I don't want to get destroyed by Hathaway later, I also hate Rollerball. I think it's terrible. I also hate Beverly Hills Cop 3.
It's because you're not remembering the Neutron Dance.
Yeah, take everything that could possibly have been done horribly in your average middle-of-the-road shit pseudo-futuristic action thriller or whatever movie in the mid-90s. Rollerball has it all.
In 2002.
Yeah.
As I said on Facebook, it's like Running Man, but it's worse.
Oh my!
To me, it feels like an episode of La Femme Nikita. You know, like it's that kind of, you know, generic Canadian industrial land posing as Russia. Sort of just
There's one of the arenas that I have to mention. It's like the Montreal Casino.
Yeah, yeah. And it plays like an arena in Azerbaijan or something.
Yeah.
I have to say, I was amazed, actually, when we started to record this, I brought up McTiernan's IMDb page, and I was amazed to find out that this was actually before Basic, because I'm going to talk more about Basic later, spoiler, but Basic actually feels like a McTiernan film, and it feels like technically he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
Rollerball feels like it was just like – the worst second unit just went crazy. And then he was kind of like, fuck it, just put it in a can.
I
was going to say that the production designer was probably passed out of fumes when he was designing those costumes.
Oh,
they hired him cheap off of American Gladiators.
The white toga thing?
The guy dressed like, who was like a fool's hat in gold or something.
LL Cool J looks like he's wearing Hulk Hogan's title belt.
LL Cool J looks like he is the Hulk, but, you know, in the fat, retired from being a bus driver years. He's sitting on that bike, it's like, is that man literally a foot wider than he is tall?
And I've seen the movie, so. You know, two or three times, unfortunately.
Oh!
And what the hell is going on in it? What's happening? Like, what is the plot?
I don't know.
I'm
looking at the plot, the plot synopsis on Wikipedia right now, and it's three very short paragraphs that don't make any sense.
Like, that's the plot.
Are you sure you didn't accidentally bring up the script, John?
I mean, like, I watched like the last 30 minutes with my brothers in the car when we were commuting, and I was trying to explain to them what went on before, and I couldn't be like, my brother was like, why are they running away? And I'm like, I don't know.
Oh, God. And the night vision sequence.
What was that about?
I don't know.
Like, this is why I don't understand how he could have made Basic afterwards, because I honestly thought that he'd just gone insane.
He looked at Rene Russo's
not an exaggeration. Like, he just lost his mind and he didn't know how to make a film anymore. And for a movie that should be about nothing but speed, every action in this is so sluggish. It's like this tiny little course that they're driving around on, overloaded with like 30 people, none of whom know what they're doing, and they're all just kind of like slogging along like they're going through a swamp. Like, there is no motion, there's no energy in this movie, and John McTiernan is such an energetic director.
I think there's one point where a bike, like, goes airborne and explodes, and it's like the really bad CG explosion, and the bike is just gone. It just vanishes.
The only energy in the flick is, like, Jean Reno, like, shouting all his line in badly accented English.
If it weren't for Jean Reno and Rebecca Romijn's breasts...
What was with her goddamn exit in that movie? Man, what was with this movie? I don't know.
Was it supposed to be from the Netherlands?
What's with casting Chris Klein in the first place?
Well, yeah, what?
I was going to say that. If one good thing came out of Rollerball, it was kind of like the stake in the heart of the Kevin Williamson era of movie characters. Yeah. You know, Chris Klein was like the personification of all these, you know, every shitty David Boreanaz and fucking Sarah Michelle Gellar, like everything that came out of Scream. It's like they personified it into one man and put him in a movie.
This is amazing.
So shitty that they just shut down that entire era of filmmaking.
His actual name, he was born Frederick Christoph Klein.
Whoa.
And this is the beginning of his description on IMDb. Possessing the sort of apple-cheeked, translucent-skinned, all-American wholesomeness that has made him a natural for the pretty boy jock roles that began his career, Chris Klein started a minor sensation after appearing in only two films. I'm not sure what that sensation was, but I think it was kind of like a gag reflex.
Well, he wasn't bad in Election.
Hey, Chris Klein, yeah. Rollerball made you an alcoholic? Congratulations. It made me one, too.
All I could think of throughout this movie is Chris Klein looks like Keanu Reeves' younger, less charismatic brother.
He's just, the character is utterly bland. And he got this whole deer caught in the headlights look in his eyes.
It's because he's drunk.
He's like, John, that's intensity.
It's like, you know, McTiernan sat in his director's chair and yelled action, and every time just prayed that Chris Klein wasn't going to whip his dick out and start masturbating because he has no fucking idea what acting is.
He doesn't know what's going on. I don't think anybody knew what was going on. I don't think McTiernan was even there half the time.
To be perfectly fair, I feel kind of bad ragging on Chris Klein, because to be perfectly honest, I thought as much as some, you know, in the center of this mess, he kind of did as much as you could do. Like, it was a zero role. There was no character whatsoever. I'm sure they didn't have any more idea of what the movie was about than the audience.
Okay, to be fair to McTiernan too, and this is the Rollerball fiasco. This was very, very, very clearly an extremely troubled production. It was delayed several times. Finally, it was just mercilessly dumped by the studio. It's where all of the Jack Pelliccino wiretapping scandal stuff came from. It's where it originated. It was against the producer of Rollerball. So there was obviously some severe backstabbing and backbiting going on during the making of the film. It was a mess.
And honestly, I think originally this was something he fought to get made.
No, this was something he did under contract to MGM.
Oh, was it? Okay.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes people say, oh, remakes will make people want to see the original, but I don't even want to see the original now.
You know what's kind of hilarious about it? McTiernan has done two remakes. He's done Rollerball and The Thomas Crown Affair. Both originals were directed by Norman Jewison.
And Thomas Crown Affair is really good,
interesting.
Actually.
Yeah.
Also, one minor plus point for Rollerball.
No.
It does have Oleg Taktarov.
It doesn't matter.
He's like a teddy bear.
It doesn't matter. It means nothing. It could have Olivia Munn and Olivia Wilde having a naked lesbian makeout scene, and it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't make a difference. It could have Rene Russo's glorious boobs, and it would still suck.
God, I remember. I just remembered the soundtrack.
So a big shout out to our female listeners. This has been They Came From St. John's. Steve and John.
We have female listeners?
Hey, on Rotten Tomatoes, it had a rating of 3.
Wow.
Who could have possibly given it a positive review?
Internet websites. Internet reviews.
Chris Klein's mom.
Chris Klein's mom.
You were the handsomest boy in that film.
Zava Klein.
I'm starting to wonder if there actually is a scene for the film,
was a
or if it's just that the editing actually puts everyone who watches it into the same green-tinged seizure at exactly the same point in the film.
I think it's you know what I think it is? I figured it out. I figured out what it is, what the deal is with Rollerball. It's an exercise by the United States government in inducing rage amongst the populace.
Hmm.
I thought you were going to say it wasn't actually directed by John McTiernan.
Oh, it probably wasn't. I'd say it was directed by whatever schmuck got all the footage and edited it together in the editing room. I'd say that's who directed it.
I also want to know why when I watched the DVD, it was rated R. But all of the violence was the most sanitized. Like, you know, if you... To be fair, I'm not big on, like, gratuitous violence, but if you're going to make a movie about people getting their heads slammed around and stuff, you have to have violence. Here, people get shot with a shotgun, and they kind of, like, fall over. There's some sparks.
Rollerball was rated R?
When I watched it on DVD, it came up with a big R for violence, language, and nudity.
Oh, okay.
Mostly violent. Mostly language.
I think it was mostly nudity.
Yeah, and language.
According to the Wikipedia page, John McTiernan at that period was actually the pseudonym of James McTeague.
Really?
That makes so much
all
more
sense. All makes sense.
The pseudonym of Lewis Teague.
Hey now. Hey.
Or was it Hal Needham?
I know you're not comparing the director of Navy SEALs to the director of Ninja Fucking Assassin.
We will not have any slam talking of Jewel Little Nile, Navy SEALs, or anything directed by Hal Needham. Thank you very much.
I love Ninja Assassin.
I love Mega Force.
I love the first 5 minutes of Ninja Assassin. That should have been the whole movie.
If we could somehow have Ninja Assassin recut so that the main character is played by a St. Bernard, it would be the greatest film ever made.
Man, I'm just totally picturing like the whole Lone Wolf and Cub shot from the end of it, now with the St. Bernard killing the shit out of Shokazugi.
Oh, so Rollerball. Right.
Yeah.
Can I talk about my ugly now?
You can,
as long as it's Rollerball.
Please!
No. Okay, we have to pass some hate towards Basic. I will not hear any defense of this film.
I just hate it. I'm not going to defend it. It is indefensible. But I can't bring myself to hate it.
No sense.
No, it doesn't.
They wrote Mad Libs for the script.
The movie
Giovanni Ribisi is playing some kind of unholy union of Kevin Spacey and Ted Levine as, you know, homosexual stereotype. While we were in the jungle, there was an explosion.
He's supposed to be Harvard-educated.
Harvard-educated. My father always looked at me as kind of weak, and I think that's why I went into the whole military thing to begin with. Time's running out. Tick-tock.
Fortunately, his head explodes in a geyser of blood.
Time's running out. Muffy, bring the schooner around to the... the front of the lake.
My God. And literally, I mean, there are so many twists in this film, and they are all negated by the final point, at which point, I mean, it's one thing to say that, you know, all the stories people were telling in this sort of Rashomon-esque approach to, you know, some kind of killing in the jungle, you know, those stories were negated, but there are actions made by characters that make literally no sense. At the end of the movie, you find out that two characters you thought were at odds were actually in it together.
Yeah.
And they had the same information, and yet one of them held one's head up to an airplane propeller until he broke down to reveal information that wasn't a secret.
But goddamn, that scene was awesome.
This is what happens when you lie!
And there's a scene in which Connie Nielsen, there's a completely pointless and wholly unrealistic fight between John Travolta and Connie Nielsen, which starts with John Travolta being launched through a door upside down into a room, and then they do this kind of like martial arts flipping fight, and then it almost turns into a kiss, and then Connie Nielsen's gun comes up because no. incidentally, Connie Nielsen starts with a deep Southern drawl, and halfway through the movie, suddenly she's back in Denmark or wherever the hell she's from. It's insane. You want to talk about, you know, Rebecca Romijn having an incomprehensible accent in Rollerball. Connie Nielsen, it's like she's a Martian who just dropped in. And why do we all of a sudden have, you know, some Scandinavian interrogating people in a Panamanian American army base.
And why the hell is she married to Lars Ulrich from Metallica?
Here's the point where I have to admit that I didn't get past 40 minutes into basic.
Dude, it's in a way, it's almost like you missed something beautiful. Because it's kind of like, you know, suddenly realizing that the entire way you've looked at the universe is entirely backwards.
It's still not as bad as Rollerball.
It folds in on itself.
The plot is total horseshit, but at least there is a plot. The
only real problem I had with Basic is it all comes down to the last fight. And, you know, I don't even mind twists so much. It's just, guys, if you're going to try to be Ocean's 11 or anything, if you're going to try to be clever, you've got to be written intelligently.
Yeah.
Right? You just throw a plot twist in the end that negates the entire runtime of the movie.
I wouldn't even mind that, other than the gaps in logic, like the whole like what Andrew was saying about the whole helicopter or the airplane
and
propeller.
And the whole switching dog tags? Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
this guy just waltzed onto base and he's like, oh, well, we thought he was in, but actually it was some. Okay, and also, you know, as if I needed another item on my list of grievances, this has one of the campest performances by John Travolta in a particularly camp period of his career. He starts out his interrogation by sprawling across a table like he's in a, you know, red sequin dress on a piano. Well, you know, I don't know if you're going to win over this guy that way, Travolta.
Just to be fair, he got himself in some pretty fantastic shape for Basic, so...
He did.
You know what? He starts out in that shot, you know, he's got this shirtless shot stepping out of the shower, and... Some people said he looked in great shape. To me, it looked more like he was kind of like stitched and stapled in the way that people make those like potato people out of stuffed stockings. You know, all the ins and outs were in the right places, but they were glued and
sagged. Painted on his bare gut.
And then they just kind of like slathered some olive oil on there. And
they
like,
airbrushed some muscles.
No, it wasn't airbrushing. There was definite dimension, okay? But it was like he was made – it was like he was a balloon animal made at a child's birthday party, but in a really inappropriate way.
Was that the movie where it was the big – I remember there being a flick where there was a shirtless scene and the guy's muscles were CG'd. Was that Basic?
No, that's Ghost Rider.
Oh, okay.
With Nick Cage.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I was going to see like – Basic just couldn't draw me in, while Rollerball is like a big neon car crash that you can't look away from because it's so bad.
Gabe, you only saw 40 minutes in, man. Yeah. You have no idea.
Basic to me is just, it's horribly, horribly flawed, whereas Rollerball is like, you know, I'm looking at the big picture window of my house and watching a dog take a big creamy shit on the lawn.
But here's the thing.
I can't look away. I know it's something I don't want to see, and I'll never eat steak again. But
here's why Rollerball doesn't seem as tragic to me. I look at Rollerball, and it's like, this is such a mess that obviously it went out of control. You know? I look at Basic, and this is a movie that is completely in control and making the dumbest story anyone has ever conceived.
Yeah.
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 You're sitting there watching, this isn't the director of Hunt for Red October. It can't be.
No. It's baffling.
Ugh.
Die hard, guys! Die hard!
With a vengeance!
That's what I don't like about this format, because I always end up feeling like shit at the end.
I like to think of Basic as Die Hard in a stroke.
With that, any closing thoughts on John McTiernan?
Who's going first?
It's like watching a beloved grandparent drift away into the fog of senility. Honestly, he was a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker, and I hope he comes back. Because when he was at the height of his powers, he, you know, there are a few just elite action directors. You know, say what you will about his latest sort of bloated films and, you know, apparent sense of importance. You know, just write Titanic and Avatar out. James Cameron's one of them in terms of just being able to film an action scene. John Woo, and John McTiernan is right up there. And obviously Spielberg. I mean, there's a few, but he was one of the elite action directors.
He's definitely got a gift.
And not just action, but, you know, he had a gift for storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I hope that comes back.
And suspense.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's stylistically off the chain, but his style is not his crutch. You know, like the style is part of the form and function of his work. You know, you sit down and you watch Die Hard. Die Hard is a relentlessly stylish film, but it never feels like the style is being crammed down your throat. Like, he never pulls a Tony Scott, you know?
No.
Like,
no.
His style,
it's always style in service of the film.
Yeah, it's not his calling card. It's just his innate ability, you know?
And if there's anything that I think is going to prevent him from coming back to, you know, the height of his career, it's that the way he makes an action film, you know, it's no less exciting. It's every bit as modern, I think, in many ways as, you know, action films we have today. Unlike, you know, going back and looking at an old James Bond, which just is something totally different. He can still make a thoroughly exciting, energetic action film. But I think the fact that he won't construct it the way that people expect it these days.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
It's going to prevent him from really.
Yeah, and that he knows how to take his time and how to shoot an action scene coherently instead of, you know, like putting his camera in a dryer or something and rolling it around.
So we need you, John McTiernan. We need you. We need.
I am
old John McTiernan back again.
I've been saying it for years. For a director who's lesser than John McTiernan, I always tell people, you know, I don't want. I get sad that Rennie Harlan is going out as the director of a John Cena action movie.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
That makes me weep, but McTiernan deserves so much better than to go out on the 1-2 punch of Rollerball and Basic.
Yeah, he deserves one last shot, man.
But this is a man who. You give him a bit of money, give him a good script, and give him a camera, and he delivers 10 times out of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
And he deserves better than what the late 90s brought us.
And that about does it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Thanks, boys. Be sure to tune in next week when we tackle the visual cinematic stylings of British director Ridley Scott, Part 1.